You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
It is a great honour for us to announce that we have reached an agreement on the Iranian nuclear issue. With courage, political will, mutual respect and leadership, we delivered on what the world was hoping for, a shared commitment to peace and to join hands in order to make our world safer.
Raffaello Pantucci and Quentin Peel are here to tell us whether the long-awaited agreement is a good deal for any or all parties. Then we'll head to Greece to consider the task facing Alexis Tsipras. He's struck a deal, but can he sell it at home?
For Topotami, there is no dilemma. We support the Prime Minister and we will vote for what he has promised our European allies. Topotami will not be a standard opposition party. It will remain a responsible political force.
All that, plus news of the latest human rights crackdown in China and the Football World Cup for the stateless. That's all to come on today's edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci and Quentin Peel. Raffaello is the Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Quentin is an Associate Fellow at Chatham House and a contributor for the Financial Times. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us as always. Let's start with Iran. Following years of frosty relations and on-off negotiations, world powers have finally reached a deal with Iran regarding its nuclear programme. Earlier today, Iran and six world powers signed a deal which will limit Iranian nuclear activity in return for the lifting of international economic sanctions. Quentin, perhaps I'll start with you. A deal which will surely be welcomed pretty much around the world, one would have imagined, give or take one or two exceptions. But is it a good deal?
I think it's as good as we could have possibly hoped for, really. It's clearly not perfect. It's not going to be easy to enforce. And it is going to infuriate, as you hinted, two particular countries, Israel and Saudi Arabia. And it'll have a very difficult passage through the US Congress because Israel will pull out every stop to try and block it. But I think that it's a very good deal for what it represents. It's brought together Europe, America, the Russians, the Chinese, and it's actually brought Iran significantly back into the fold. That can't be bad.
Raffaello, we'll perhaps talk about Israel and the Saudis in a moment, but for exactly the reasons that Quentin identifies there, this is presumably a moment that we should be marking, well, if not celebrating, certainly marking with some degree of enthusiasm.
I certainly think it's a very positive moment, but I do think that there are some quite substantial problems that are sort of lurking on the horizon. And actually, I think what's quite interesting is while it generates a lot of goodwill, certainly between the EU and US, showing that, you know, we can do these sorts of deals and that, you know, sanctions, if applied with enough rigor and diplomatic engagement, can really turn around a situation which was perceived to be, as you know, impossible to break. The worry for me is what are the sort of secondary and tertiary consequences of this act? You know, nothing ever happens in a vacuum, you know, and the consequences of this, and I think the repercussions, I actually think Israel, you know, I think there's sort of workable ways with that, but I think the implications to the other Gulf countries and their thinking and how concerned they are, and in fact, how concerned they are about what this means about the growing relationship between Iran and the West. You know, you look at Iran, it's a country of, what, 90 million people? It's got a relatively functioning industrial base, it's got a relatively functioning economy, which is now going to be unleashed, you know, and you put that up against a Saudi economy or a lot of the other Gulfy ones, which is basically extractives and a small elite who is sort of, you know, keeping all the money while everyone else is ill-educated. And, you know, it's just, it could have a real game-changing geopolitical shift, which I don't know if we've really seen the sort of longer-term consequences of that.
Quentin, do you think that, I mean, has there been any sort of short-termism then in terms of some of the parties who are involved in this not being alive to those consequences? Or do you think that they were well aware of them and they decided that nevertheless this was a course of action that had to be pursued to its end?
I think the latter. I think they were very well aware of them. I think that, I mean, there's been this poison in the Middle East between Shia and Sunni, the constant rivalry there. And it's got to be dealt with at some stage. The boil has got to be lanced. It can't go on just poisoning the atmosphere interminably. And I do not really see how this deal makes it worse. I realise that obviously a country like Saudi might turn around and say, this is going to allow them to have nuclear weapons, therefore we've got to have nuclear weapons too. But that would be right in the face of the Americans. It would. I just don't think. I think it is a better deal to at least grab the chance of restraining Iran from going down that route. Can't be bad.
Now, Rafael, we talked about Israel. The reaction has obviously been as forthright as perhaps we would have expected. You've had Netanyahu, who's called it a historical mistake. The deputy foreign minister called it a historic surrender by the West, and continued with this phrase that to the axis of evil headed by Iran, using this sort of rhetoric that most involved in the negotiations seem to have moved on from. Unsurprising that that's the rhetoric. I mean, and how do we address the problem of the Israeli attitude to Iran's inclusion in these talks in the first place?
Look, I think, for all my sort of doom and gloom comments before about what the secondary and tertiary consequences are, I think that some sort of deal did have to be reached. You do have to engage with the Iranians, and that's kind of the end of it. And I think that this was the best kind of deal that could be expected. I think, Quentin's spot on the money, frankly, when he talks about, these issues are ones that are hugely problematic, and we're always going to upset someone, and with the Israelis, you were always going to have Netanyahu, and Netanyahu particularly administration was going to come out very strongly against this, kind of no matter how it was really shaped, and they will continue to. And you can already see people here in London who are, very anti this sort of thing, mobilizing themselves to sort of start lobbying government and shouting about it more. I think that was always going to be a reality. I think, and it really is. And I unfortunately think that what one would hope is that this has changed some sort of a fundamental thing that means that at least this one problem has been addressed. There are lots of other problems as well, and this will make some of them worse, will complicate others. But one would hope that now we can turn and sort of start to look at those. But at least this one has been moved into a sort of more positive direction. And
don't you think, Rafaela, that it's also very interesting that actually within Iran, who was opposing this deal? It was the conservatives in Iran. It was the hardliners in Iran. And actually, here's a very young country, and a country with enormous upside possibilities. And I think that to open up rather than to close down relations with a country like that is in the long term going to be much more positive.
No, I agree 100%. I think if you look at the relations of what the impact of a sort of more positive Iranian engagement with the West could be, for example, in Central Asia, for example, in Afghanistan, for example, in that broader space where we've had a lot of concerns for a long time, there's a potential that you've got a power there that could actually be an ally and be a force for good. That's potentially hugely, hugely positive. So, I think that there are lots of upsides to it, but I do worry that in the short term, you are going to see some very substantial pushback. And then, of course, what's always funny about, what's always interesting, I suppose, is within all these geopolitical deals, is that it so often comes back to what domestic American politics and how it will play against them. And I think that the atmosphere in Congress at the moment is pretty acerbic against against the Obama administration. And I think that's a huge hurdle that needs to be somehow overcome as well.
Well, let's talk a bit more about that. I mean, what do we think Quentin Obama's going to face? He's clearly going to face criticism. We know Congress has this longer period in which to analyse this, to vote before they vote in favour or otherwise. Obama has said that, every pathway to a nuclear weapon is cut off. Will that be enough to appease his more moderate critics?
Well, he's certainly not going to appease his extreme critics. But he said flatly he's going to, if there is an attempt to block this, he will veto that. And then you have to get a two-thirds majority in both houses to override that veto. So I think on the whole, it'll take time. There'll be a lot of sound and fury, but I think he can get his way on this one. And it really will set the tone, I think, at least that I'm sure is what he hopes, for an administration that has shown that actually it is long, bloody-minded, patient diplomacy that delivers. And this is a 12-year process that's been brought to an end. That's extraordinary.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because we're sort of chuckling at some of the statements you hear from Mogherini and others talking about the success that we've seen. Where does the you know, is it too simplistic, Rafael, to look and say, you know, the credit rests somewhere? Is it just having enough people willing to take the time, to be patient, to trust that good old-fashioned diplomacy to do the job? Is that where the credit really lies then?
I think it is long-term patient diplomacy. I mean, I think it's interesting that Mogherini has been very much the front person of this, and I think clearly she's been very involved in the last year or however long it's been she's been in that position. But, you know, before that you had Javier Solana and you had Catherine Ashton, who did a lot of work in terms of moving this process forwards during some very difficult sort of political times internationally. And so it's curious that Mogherini, you know, it's a quirk in some ways of history that, you know, Mogherini is the one who comes in and becomes the face of it, even though she's only sort of come in for the last kind of couple of laps, if you will. But I think that it is clearly a process that has been going on for a very long time, over administrations, over various different sort of political realities changing all in the world around them in all sorts of different directions. And so sort of maintaining that consistency, you know, can obviously bear fruit. I think that the point that Quentin was alluding to when he talks about the fact that this sort of, this being important to the Obama administration, I think when you take this and you take the agreement on Cuba a few weeks ago, the opening up of Cuba, I mean, this is clearly the Obama administration moving its kind of legacy into the touch zone, to use an American football terminology. You know, it's, they're showing that, you know, this is what they want to be remembered for. You know, and I think there are downsides to that in the sense that we look at what's happening with Syria and Iraq and it's floundering in other ways. I think that's because this is really where the sort of political weight and attention is being focused, because they want to show this is how you can really change the world for a positive way using kinetic means.
But it needed the Europeans to get in there as the bridge, because remember, at the beginning of this process, the Americans and the Iranians were absolutely not talking to each other. So, and you mentioned Javier Solana, right from that moment, it was very important that the Europeans were there and opened the doors and got things moving, and then kept the Russians engaged. And indeed, the Chinese may not have been heavy lifters in this, but they needed to be at the table. So all of those things, and I actually think this is one of the perhaps very few examples where European diplomacy has worked.
We talked a little bit about potential upsides. What's the limit of that, do you think, Quentin? I mean, some people are saying, look, you know, a functioning Iran that's trading, that's able to build on the sorts of foundations that Rafael was talking about in terms of commerce and business, and this population that's actually very rather open-minded as against some of the traditional stereotypes. Does this offer a wider solution to, I don't know, bigger pan-Middle Eastern problems even?
Well, if that great divide in the Middle East can be overcome, Iran, I've always seen Iran as a country of enormous hope. The trouble was, it's too often dashed. But it's young. It's got these resources which have not been exploited. They've obviously fantastic energy resources. But it's the youth of the country which is really exciting, I think. And in my heart, I just can't believe they're going to get stuck forever in a very conservative Islamist sort of regime. I think they're going to come out of that.
Raf, you say, I mean, it's interesting that you do have this, you know, this very conservative, potent conservative side of the society there. Do you think that the people who've been willing to maybe take a few risks in these negotiations will be able to sell on their side also?
I mean, I think I have to be honest, I don't know enough about sort of Iranian internal politics to know how that dynamic really plays out at home. I suspect there will be a lot of difficulties, because I think there are some very conservative voices there that are really probably pushing back against this in much the same way that there are in the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think there's this sort of domestic dynamic which always plays out, frankly, on the other side. I think the other aspect I would mention, and this is something that was alluded to before, is this sort of thing of this being at the heart of the Sunni-Shia, friction around the world. I think it's really interesting is actually, if you look back at history, when the Iranian Revolution actually happened, that was trumpeted across the Muslim world as a huge success and victory. It was seen as a victory of Islam, not Sunni or Shia Islam, but Islam over an oppressive dictator who was, you know, torturing his people. And then since then, we've had this Sunni-Shia division really sort of rip apart at the fabric of the sort of Arab world. But So in some ways, I think that, you know, but that sort of division is something that helps foster a lot of the sort of conservative voices who will shout a lot about, you know, we need to build a stronger Shia state and build the Shia crescent and help strengthen, you know, the Quds Force and Hezbollah and all these others, you know. But the reality is that isn't a permanent reality of history. And if we go back not too far to the 1970s, you can see when actually there was kind of a universal acceptance of this. So, you know, I would look at that in an optimistic way as well. And if you talk to, I think, young Iranians, they are more secular minded, or if they are religiously minded, they are not necessarily immediately ingrained in this perspective that, you know, Sunni is enemy and Shia is friendly.
But a reasonable Iran is also going to really put the pressure on the Saudis and what the Saudis are up to. And I think a lot of questions are going to be asked about the sort of tacit support that the Saudis give to Islamists on the Sunni side.
And not just the Saudis, of course. I mean, the Qataris and the other Gulfies, some of the actions, some of those powers there and what they've been doing is hugely, frankly, destructive.
So from one perhaps rather unlikely deal to another, to Greece, where lawmakers from the ruling Syriza party and their allies have been debating behind closed doors all day whether or not to back the government's austerity reforms. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has less than 48 hours to pass the measures in order to meet the terms of Greece's bailout deal. But after agreeing to tougher regulations than those rejected in the referendum, how will Tsipras sell this back home? Quentin, is this going to be a story of, you know, again, domestic rift, you know, an impossible sell for Tsipras after this extraordinarily turbulent few weeks?
Well, I think he's got a hell of a job to do, because the more you look at what he's accepted, the more one realises that actually he completely stood on his head. I mean, he's accepted a far tougher deal than anything that they've seen before, everything that they denounced as dreadful.
Was that inevitable, do you think, as it dragged on and on and this sort of Eurozone exit became what seemed like a likelihood, that they were inevitably going to have to compromise even beyond that point?
Well, I always thought that this insane strategy of calling a referendum to prove absolutely nothing was just going to actually be in your face and indeed prove nothing. It went the opposite way. But I think that the thing going for him in getting it through is that I think the Greeks are really realise that it's this or out. And suddenly, an awful lot of people realise that out looks a lot worse and a lot less certain than a very unpleasant time of staying in the Eurozone. Having said that, he's got a left wing that is really threatening, and they're peeling away by the hour, really, on the left. His right wing allies in government are also absolutely adamant that they won't support him. He may end up with a minority government. He may end up having to try and reform a government completely. He's a very persuasive guy. Another thing going for him is the rest of his coalition know that they won power a lot because of his charismatic presence. But hey, it's a big deal.
Raffaele, it's interesting to look at the sort of domestic political makeup in Greece, and a lot of people worried now that as we look into the next even couple of few years, you could see, you know, further austerity being sort of grist to the mill of the likes of Golden Dawn and other, you know, extremists on the sort of right of the political spectrum. We've talked before about the prevalence of extremism in Europe increasingly. Do you worry that inevitably the likes of Golden Dawn will capitalise on this sort of uncertainty, this sort of turbulence?
Well, yes. I mean, in any situation where you've got people who feel, you know, disengaged or angry at their government, extreme parties do appear. You know, people, if things are going bad, people need someone to blame. You know, and if you have parties that approach, which arrive with a very simplistic sort of narrative that it's all those foreigners' fault, and, you know, and that just sort of explains the world to you, and they, oh, there we go, and I need someone to blame anyway, and this is kind of a useful thing. So yes, in every sort of context where you have this kind of a turmoil, you do have more extreme parties that emerge. I think it's worrying. It's something that we've seen happen in Europe in a number of different countries where we've seen a sort of growth of some of these far-right parties. Golden Dawn is a particularly worrying one. But I mean, you know, in Greece in some ways has always had this kind of struggle between the kind of left and right. You know, they've always had these very, you know, very strong parties of political extremes on either side. And so in some ways, Golden Dawn is kind of a continuation of that. I mean, you know, I think if you look at, you know, I do a lot of work looking at terrorism and radicalization. It's very interesting because when you look at kind of the Greek case study, they still really have left-wing terrorists running around there, you know, very active groups that are sort of hangovers from way back when. So, you know, Golden Dawn are kind of an extension of that political expression. And yes, they will clearly profit from this kind of anger at the government to try to grow.
A worrying potential consequence. Quentin, what about this balance of, you know, whether it's Northern Europe and Southern Europe or the German axis and Athens? You've had Varoufakis saying this deal's a new Treaty of Versailles, coup d'etat with banks instead of tanks. Now, I mean, he's presumably thinking about his chat show career or whatever he's going to go on and do. What do you think? I mean, is he talking to a fundamental problem that's going to endure despite the deal, which is it a distrust from Athens to, you know, Berlin in particular, but or to Brussels? Do you think it's something that can be easily overcome?
I think there's a hell of a lot of bad blood there. I think there's a lot of misinterpretation too. I think one thing that Varoufakis got wrong from the start was he said it was all about Germany, and actually he didn't add up all the other people who he was infuriating. One of the interesting comments today was from the Italian finance minister, who said, you know, at the end of the day, the only countries who were trying to get a deal with Greece were France, Italy and Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was actually on the so-called German side. Mm-hmm. So I think Varoufakis got it very wrong. But that's not to say that the perception isn't a lot of bitterness. I think it's confined on the whole to Greece. That's much the worst case scenario. If you go to, say, Spain and Portugal, there's not this sort of anti-German feeling that you get there. But the other thing I think is really interesting about this whole exercise is it's focused again on a very important and very difficult divide at the heart of the Eurozone, and that's the difference between Germany and France. They still have very different views of how to run the Eurozone. Germany absolutely adamant, no bailout, very strict rules. We must have a strong currency and we mustn't have loose monetary policy. And the French always trying to get round it. And I go back 6 years ago, I was in Berlin, and a very senior figure in the German government, before the Greek crisis came, and I said, aren't you worried about Greece? And he said, you know what really worries us about Greece? Behind the Greeks might stand the French. I said, what do you mean? And he said, they'll try and rewrite the rules of the whole Eurozone because of a Greek crisis.
Let me ask you then, Quentin, about that, because some people have said, oh, you know, this is the first time we've seen, and I'll do these sort of inverted commas, you know, the real Germany here. Now, whether that's in terms of its preoccupations with maintaining the EU project in its current form, or whether it's talking about, you know, German self-interest, I'm not quite sure. But what do you think about that? I mean, do you think we have seen a real side of Berlin in the last few weeks?
I think that tends to suggest that it's just a one-sided thing. The German debate is very complicated. I think what we have seen in Germany is a German stubbornness about actually really showing a bit more flexibility on fiscal policy, and absolutely insisting it's the rules. You know what they say about German economic policy? It's like a branch of moral theology. It is incredibly moralistic. And I don't think the Germans see that themselves. But having said that, the Germans are putting a lot of... This is not going to be easy to get through the German Bundestag at all. The Germans are being forced to put a lot more money on the line. And if there is a Grexit at any stage, still, because it all goes wrong, Germany is going to be burnt far more than anybody else.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests, Raffaello Pantucci and Quentin Peel. Up next, we'll talk about China continuing its crackdown on activists and a World Cup for the separatist regions. Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
What we're trying to do is to keep our tentacles spread far and wide, I suppose, for this vast, vast country and this really dynamic city too here in Toronto, to try and bring the most accurate and the most vibrant flavour we can of this place that we hold so dearly to us.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me, my guests today, Raffaello Pantucci and Quentin Peel. Now, as China continues its crackdown on activists, it's now turned to those who take on cases involving free speech, human rights and abuses of power. More than 70 Chinese lawyers, including some of the country's most prominent human rights defenders, have been detained or questioned over the last few days. Raffaello, we've seen the Chinese government attempting to sort of impose an order on its populace to maintain social order. Is this the latest misguided bid to do exactly that?
Yes, frankly. I mean, it's actually a really sad story. And I mean, it's part of a trend in some ways that we've seen, which is quite depressing in China, in that we've seen that since Xi Jinping has come to power, he's very much been about centralizing power. And on the one hand, there was a perception this could be seen as a good thing because he was a big anti-corruption drive, and corruption in China is a huge problem. And there were some really nasty people who are making a fortune, frankly. And we've seen a number of them been torn down. And frankly, it's in good time. You know, it's no time too soon for Zhou Yongkang to go to prison or something like that. So that's on the one side fantastic. The problem is that what we've also seen is that there has been a more general kind of crackdown, and it was difficult always to understand and see where it was going. But now that we've had, you know, 50 lawyers, human rights lawyers, arrested in a big sweep, which is I think the biggest that we've seen recently, we've seen some human rights defenders, there's a prominent Uyghur activist professor, he's an economics professor at a university in Beijing, who got a life sentence, you know, for basically writing some things against the state. I mean, these are very harsh punishments that are being meted out on people who are really, you know, trying to shine light on government malfeasance or on people's, frankly, human rights abuses being trampled. It is very kind of negative and dark on the one side. And as I say, it's a kind of darker side to, in some ways, what some people might would seem to be a kind of lighter vision of what was coming forward.
I guess a lot of people looking in from the outside would say, look, an approach that seems to be focused on this notion that if there's no lawyers to defend people, then there's no problem, seems incredibly short-sighted. And surely there must be an awareness of how these sorts of actions are perceived from without. Is this, again, just bloody-mindedness? There's no actual concern that that is how the Western media and Western governments are going to view this sort of activity.
Well, they don't care about that, frankly speaking. I mean, what does it matter to the Chinese government if, you know, the New York Times starts writing articles about this or gets angry about it? They just block the site, which is what they're doing. You know, so I think it's really quite blunt in that perspective. And I don't think, you know, I think we fixate a lot on this. And, you know, I think, frankly, the UAE, the Chinese government realizes that, you know, well, it kind of, we can do these things and we can advance these policies in a relatively, you know, consequence-free environment. I mean, you know, the European Union has a human rights dialogue with the Chinese that, you know, I had heard one instance that, you know, they were even rejecting visas for people who meant to go over for these sorts of meetings. You know, and if you're taking the dialogue that seriously, I mean, is it really even worth doing in some ways? And yet, Europeans, Americans still want to engage. So the Chinese government, you know, these voices from outside shouting about it just don't matter, frankly.
Quentin, we talked a little bit about, you know, seemingly intractable geopolitical problems already in the programme. This is another one. Where does the solution for this sort of problem come if even those who are trying to give voice to the voiceless are, you know, being persecuted? Does it come from without, within China? What's the answer?
I suspect it comes from within China primarily, and I suspect that actually this clampdown, this renewed clampdown on the human rights activists, may be a sign of weakness rather than a sign of strength. The at a time when they're having a go at corruption, which is endemic in the party structures and right through the system, that's incredibly destabilizing. So maybe we're seeing, you know, him trying to play it both ways so he can say to the party, look, some of you are going to lose your heads, but don't worry, I'm reinforcing things by clamping down on the human rights guys. Having said that, it's a very sorry day for some very brave people.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to quickly talk about an alternative World Cup for stateless, unrecognised or self-declared nations. Football teams from various rebel republics are gathering in Abkhazia next year for a World Cup between the teams not recognised by FIFA. One might think with FIFA's recent problems, that's probably a good thing. It's the second edition of the Confederation of Independent Football Nations, or CONIFA, World Cup. There's 26 teams. We've got a sheet here with a few of their badges on. Raf, it sounds a bit like a sort of madcap football story, but actually there's something rather kind of charming and pleasing about this, isn't there?
I mean, you know, on the one hand, I agree. I sort of looked at it and said, oh, isn't this great? You know, these poor countries that don't get recognized get to, you know, get to have teams and have some sort of national identity. But then I was being hosted in Abkhazia and it's all basically being supported by the Russians, which makes me suspect that there is probably some sort of a proxy game happening here, frankly.
Quentin, there's some wonderful teams competing. Cascadia, yeah, is my favourite. The sort of Pacific Northwest US separatist movement, of which I was not previously aware, I must admit. Is Raf right? Should we worry about, you know, where the financing and where the sort of political backing to this comes from? Or is it something we can look at and enjoy with a sort of a degree of levity?
It's pretty odd. I do suspect that there's a Russian hand in it. But I must admit, it's lovely to see Darfur United out there, with none of them having had visas, and they all had to sort it out through the Swedes and the UN to get there at all.
Well, good luck to all of them. And many thanks to my guests, Raffaello Pantucci and Quentin Peel, for joining me on today's Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Guy Lutz, Mariana Zuniga, Paige Reynolds and Malcolm Chachoglian. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Great music on the way. Ben Ryland keeping you company through till 1900 with his selection from our playlist of tracks. And this show's back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.